Welcome to TP Talks, PwC's Global Transfer Pricing podcast series. I am your host, Christina Novak. I'm a principal in PwC's U.S. National Tax Practice, and I'm happy to be back with our next episode. Today, we'll be turning our attention to Amount B of the OECD's Pillar 1 initiative, where we'll spend some time focusing on the OECD's recent public consultation document on Amount B. But before we start, let me introduce today's guest speakers. They are no strangers to this podcast. First, I have Georgia Maffini. She is a transfer pricing and tax policy director with PwC UK. She formerly served as the deputy head of the tax policy and statistics division at the OECD. Also joining me is Kartike Singh. Kartike is a principal in PwC's US national tax practice and has authored several articles covering Pillar 1. Georgia, Kartike, thank you both for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Christina. Delighted to be back on the podcast.
Thank you. Likewise.
Wonderful. Well, before we dive into the specifics on Amount B, I think it would be helpful if we started from the top and remind our listeners of what is Pillar 1 and what is Amount B under Pillar 1. Georgia, would you mind please starting us off with a brief introduction to this topic?
Thank you, Christina. So Pillar 1 is the part of the OECD project that looks at creating new taxing rights for market jurisdictions. And also it aims at increasing the amount of profit that we allocate or attribute to those market jurisdictions. Under Pillar 1, we have two parts, Amount A and Amount B. Today, we will focus on Amount B, and Amount B is really addressing a very specific issue. So it provides a fixed return for existing marketing and distribution activities. So Amount B alters the return that we give to those activities in the market, but does not create new taxing rights, unlike Amount A of Pillar 1. Really, the aim of Amount B is to simplify, to streamline the pricing procedures around basic marketing and distribution activities. Amount B should be in line with the arm's length principle, again, unlike Amount A, that instead goes beyond the ALP. And Amount B is designed, we are told, to help countries with fewer resources and also to minimize disputes around distribution activities.
Thank you. So the idea behind Amount B was to take some of these endless disputes regarding pricing for routine marketing and distribution activities off the table, and in its place have this simplified mechanism to price these transactions and thereby achieving both simplicity and tax certainty for both taxpayers and tax administrations. It was meant to streamline and simplify the pricing while also being consistent with the arm's length principle. Georgia, there was a public consultation document issued by the OECD on Amount B back in December of last year. Can you bring our listeners up to speed on what has happened with Amount B since then?
Yes, Christina. So on the 17th of July this year, so 2023, the OECD has released another consultation document on Amount B, and the consultation will close very soon on the 1st of September. This consultation really follows, as you said, an identical consultation from December 2022. The July 2023 consultation is in fact a very useful step forward, I think, because the consultation document is much more focused than the previous one, because it really gives us a much more defined design of the scope of Amount B, and also very usefully some specific figures for the returns or for the pricing. But some challenges remain, and in particular, the consultation document is a secretariat's document, and the proposals in those documents, therefore, do not represent the consensus view on the of the inclusive framework. And this could have implications for various issues. One is whether Amount B will ever happen at all, but also this will have implications for the timing, because the OECD plans to include the text on amount B in the transfer pricing guidelines by January next year, so January 2024. But it really doesn't look like consensus is easily within reach yet, at least.
So it sounds like there's been at least some progress, at least with respect to the design and scope of the amount B pricing mechanism. Kartike, building off of what Georgia just described regarding the design elements of amount B, can you provide us with more detail on what was covered in the July consultation document and how the draft may have taken previous input submitted in response to the December consultation document?
Yeah, certainly. And the July consultation document does cover a lot of ground, and there are signs, exactly as Georgia said, that they have, you know, advanced the ball in certain key areas. There's more definitive provisions or at least design features in this document. There are lots of challenges that remain, a lot of questions that remain, but the document has a number of important components, the first of which is obviously a threshold question of what is in scope, what transactions and activities are in scope. And it approaches this in two parts, by first looking at a set of qualifying transactions that are potentially in scope. And these are so-called buy-sell marketing and distribution arrangements, but also include sales agency and commissioner arrangements, where an entity actually contributes to the wholesale distribution of products, but where the actual third-party sales are made by an affiliated entity. So those are potentially in scope. And then when it comes to deciding and determining whether those activities and related transactions are in scope, that's where things get a little bit more complicated. And instead of having a definitive set of scoping criteria, what the document does is it lays out two potential alternatives that it labels rather unimaginatively as alternative A and alternative B. And it's important that the alternatives actually signify a fundamental disconnect or disagreement between two sets of countries in terms of what they prefer. And alternative A has been sort of framed or positioned as a quantitative approach, and alternative B has been framed as a qualitative approach. But in reality, there are qualitative elements in both, but alternative B has more qualitative elements. And I'll start with alternative A, where when you start with those qualified transactions to see whether those transactions are in fact going to be eligible for that simplified and streamlined approach that Georgia described, you would start by first answering the question under general principles that are there in the OECD guidelines, whether the transaction and the activity lends itself to the application of a one-sided method, with the distributor being serving as the tested party. So in other words, all those things that determine, you know, things like whether it's routine, so on and so forth, and whether a one-sided method like the TNMM can apply. So that's the first criteria, and fairly facts and circumstances based, straight off the bat. The second aspect in alternative A is this quantitative filter. And by looking at basically your operating expense to sales ratio, and for the tested party distributor, where that ratio needs to be between a defined range, 3% and 30% is what's there in the document right now, without much description or discussion as to why those thresholds are set at those values. Then there's this requirement that, you know, the distributor cannot cover services. So it has to relate to the tangible goods. And finally, it should not be performing non-distribution activities, or to the extent that it performs non-distribution activities, those activities can be reliably segmented and separately tested under the most appropriate method under general transfer pricing principles. So that's alternative A. Alternative B has all of those features, but on top of that has this qualitative assessment that if the distributor in question meets all these other criteria, but then is found to undertake so-called non-baseline activities, where its contributions go above and beyond what we would consider baseline, then it should not qualify for amount B, notwithstanding the fact that it would still be eligible for a one-sided method. It would still serve as a tested party, but its contributions would be viewed as going beyond baseline. So it's a more of a qualitative and subjective assessment that retains this additional qualitative filter to weed out and make these a distributor that meets all these other criteria still non-eligible for amount B. So that's on the scoping. And then there are a lot of other aspects and complexities that are there in the, in how you determine, how you calculate those ratios, et cetera, that we talked about. So that's on scope. There's a lot of material out there. The second major component, which is really, in many ways, the core of amount B, is that simplified pricing approach that would apply to in-scope distributors. And here there's evidence that, so if you go back to the December document, there were two possibilities that were under consideration, a pricing matrix approach and a so-called mechanical pricing tool. The pricing matrix would be a grid, and you would look at certain attributes of the tested party distributor, and that would then map into a particular cell in the grid, and that cell would tell you what the appropriate arm's length target profitability should be based on the appropriate NPI. I should also say, just backing up a second, that under the pricing approach, by design, the appropriate method is supposed to be the TNMM, and the appropriate net profit indicator is supposed to be the return on sales or the operating margin. And having said that, then, if I go back to what I described earlier, that the two alternatives that were being considered in the December document, the pricing matrix or a grid versus the mechanical pricing tool, which would be a formula where you would input certain attributes of the tested party distributor, and that formula would then tell you what the required rate of return or NPI should be. This document, based on a lot of feedback, and this is, a sign that they did look at a lot of the feedback and incorporated it, they have adopted the pricing matrix approach. And the reasons seem to be that it's, simpler, it's all else equal, it's easier to adopt and implement. And then there are several other aspects like documentation, transitional issues, et cetera, that the document also covers. But I wanted to focus primarily on those two key components, scope and pricing.
Thank you for that. So regarding the scoping criteria, I think at least compared to the December consultation document, there's some good news in that the prior consultation document had proposed 12 different quantitative and qualitative criteria. And now this new July consultation document has sort of whittled that list down to 4 scoping criteria. Though the two scoping alternatives that you reference, alternative A and alternative B, seems to be a huge point of disagreement among the countries. Georgia, can you explain why that is and tell us a little bit more about the different alternatives?
Yes, Christina. So as Kartikeya has anticipated, the divide is really about introducing an additional qualitative criterion that would be there to scope out some distributors from amount A. So what is this additional criterion? As Kartikeya told us, this criterion is called option B. And this gets very confusing because we have an option B under amount B. So for clarity, we have decided that we will relabel option B as the tea leaf reading approach. And we have chosen this name because the approach really seems to be based on some rather subjective criteria. In other words, to scope out some distributors, we would need to identify distributors for which we can find comparables, but distributors that at the same time perform non-routine, non-baseline functions. Once we have identified these distributors, we should scope them out of amount B. Clearly, it's not going to be easy to identify non-routine, non-baseline functions. The other option, again, as anticipated by Kartikeya, is called option A. Again, very confusing because under pillar one, we have amount A, but here we have option A under amount B. So again, we relabeled option A as the just the fact facts approach. And this is because under the just the facts approach, countries seem to be satisfied that the combination of qualitative and quantitative screens described by Kartikeya will be able to scope out those distributors that perform non-routine, non-baseline functions, but at the same time can be priced using the classical TNMM. So two options, Christina, the tea leaf reading approach, the more subjective approach, and the just the fact approach that is based more, relies more at least on quantitative ratios.
I love the labels that you've ascribed to both of these alternatives. Do you have any insight as to why countries are disagreeing with respect to both of these scoping alternatives?
I think the document hints at some, and apparently those that support the tea leaf reading approach do so because they fear profit shifting. But I'm not sure this is particularly convincing because, for example, the returns proposed for amount B, and I know Kartikeya will get into the details of that, are not exactly low returns in the market. In particular, the upper bound will be well above the returns we get in our internal analysis, to be honest. So it's also interesting to note in the document that the supporters of this tea leaf reading approach provide some very detailed explanations in the document of why the quantitative screens are problematic, so they cannot support the just the facts approach. And in particular, in one of the reasons why the quantitative ratios would not be doing a good job is that in the empirical analysis done by the OECD, there is no correlation between those baseline distributors that we want to scope out and the quantitative screens, for example, the ratio of total operating expenses to net sales. And I think this idea that there is no correlation is at least contested, or many would disagree with this statement, or many would at least argue that other ratios, other quantitative ratios, could be identified to scope out the non-baseline distributors. But overall, we don't know much about the empirical analysis done by the OECD, so it's difficult to assess whether the statement on the correlation can be supported or not. So a big question mark there. Another reason for not supporting just the fact approach is that because there are some variations across accounting standards, in particular with respect to the definition of operating expenses, the quantitative screens would be vulnerable to manipulation. But again, for example, in the context of Pillar 2, countries do not seem worried about using different accounting standards across different jurisdictions.
This appears to be an overly meticulous justification for obstructing a project with potentially significant benefits. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's useful to take a step back and try and reflect on what is going on here. In essence, I think that amount B limits the tax authority's capacity to advocate for higher returns should they want to. So in a way, under amount B, tax authorities give up a valuable option, an option that they find valuable for, of course, the benefit of simplification. And this lost option can be regained through discretion in determining the scope and the applicability of the fixed return, so of amount B. So this is probably what we are seeing, our belief reading approach, really. And I think regaining this option is particularly important for some resource-rich authorities, and also for those authorities that have been aggressively focused on distribution margins. Overall, I think one could doubt whether countries favoring the tea leaf reading approach are really supporting amount B, because the tea leaf reading approach really still needs extensive resource draining delineation work, which we know is clouded with uncertainty. So really, probably amount B is a bit the test of whether there is a sufficient number of countries and stakeholders at the inclusive framework interested in balancing revenue generation with promoting certainty and protecting investment and growth, rather than solely focusing on revenue raising objectives.
Interesting. Thank you, Georgia. I want to go back to one of the first things that we discussed about Amount B. The stated goals were simplicity and certainty, and taking these endless disputes over routine marketing and distribution activities sort of off the table. Kartike, I'm going to turn back to you. Are we on the path to achieving these goals, or have we just shifted the argument to something else? For example, the scoping provisions. Will we now be disputing whether or not a company is in or out of scope for purposes of Amount B? And if that's the case, how much certainty have we really provided taxpayers and tax administrations? And second part of the question, does Amount B actually address the real underlying causes of all the controversy related to routine distributors? In other words, are the disputes mostly around whether or not the pricing for a routine distributor should be return on sales of 3% versus 4%, or whether the entity is a routine entity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, Georgia gave a great overview in terms of sort of motivating and actually touching upon a lot of the themes that are relevant to the question and actually addressing some of the points. And the short answer is that based on what we see in the document today, it would be a stretch to say that it's addressed or that it looks like addressing all the sources of uncertainty and controversy that relates to these types of transactions. And exactly as you said, to answer that question, one has to go back to what it is. What are the types of issues that give rise to that controversy? And it is certainly not just about what the appropriate target return should be, or what is the right set of comparables. That's a question that comes up, or that's an issue or an aspect that comes up much further down the chain of analysis, right? There are much more basic questions that, you know, is this a routine entity? And again, that's a facts and circumstances based analysis that often leads to disagreement between, depending on who's looking at those facts and circumstances, right? Then what should be the appropriate method? Should it be a one-sided method? Should it be a two-sided method? Even if it's a one-sided method, what should be the appropriate net profit indicator? That oftentimes is a huge deal. You know, whether you use something like a BEI ratio that gives you a return on your operating expenses or a return on sales, as would be the case under the ROS, can give you very different answers and often is a bone of contention. So suffice it to say that there are many, many aspects that give rise to controversy. And this, at best, what this might do is address one element or one aspect of that controversy. And exactly as you said, it may put the nature or the focus of the controversy on much more basic questions like, is this distributor really in scope of Amount B because it meets all the scoping criteria? And then there are other questions around, even if it does, but it performs, let's say, some non-distribution activities, so you need to segment those out and price them under a separate method, what allocation criteria and segmentation frameworks do you need to apply? And those are not spelled out, and they cannot be spelled out in terms of a formula. So those there are many, many things that are unlikely to be resolved in a way that you would have complete certainty and complete elimination of controversy. And then I haven't even touched upon, not from a standpoint of controversy per se, but from a taxpayer standpoint, there is going to be a lot of uncertainty around, okay, what is the ultimate outcome that they would be looking at from a pricing standpoint when you look at the pricing framework?
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think at the end of the day, this is all a balancing act, right? The intent is for amount B to be consistent with the arm's length principle, but to do that, it needs to be reliable. So presumably you would require more robust scoping provisions to accomplish that, but then the more scoping provisions you add, the more complexity you're also adding, which cuts against the goal of simplicity. Karthike, going back to the July consultation document, you had mentioned that the pricing matrix is the core of amount B. Can you explain how it works?
Yes, I will try my best. So it is a core element. And like I said, it represents a choice where that mechanical pricing tool was discarded and this a relatively more simple pricing matrix approach was adopted. And what this is that this is a grid where the underlying data and the econometric analysis that Georgia had alluded to has been distilled into an outcome that has been summarized across two dimensions. And those two dimensions represent an industry grouping. So in other words, you would look towards the tested party distributors industry grouping to see, okay, where does it place on that grid across that dimension, i.e. industry. And then the other dimension is factor intensity, which itself is a function of two or a combination of two variables, asset intensity or operating assets to sales ratio and functional intensity or operating expense to sales ratio, right? And using these two dimensions, so your industry grouping and your factor intensity, a grid with 15 cells has been constructed. So in other words, three industry groupings, and they've been grouped together based on the econometric results that the OECD found based on industries that had lower than average profitability, all else equal, industries that had average profitability, all else equal, and then industries that had higher than average profitability, all else equal. So that's one dimension. And the other dimension is this factor intensity, like I said, is a combination of two variables, operating intensity and asset intensity. And factor intensity in this grid has five categories. So in other words, five non-overlapping ranges of factor intensity. And together, that has been used to construct this 5x3 matrix, a 5x3 grid. And then in theory, the application of that grid is relatively straightforward. You would look to see, your tested party distributor, what industry grouping it belongs to, and then where it places among those five possible factor intensity ranges, and you would place it in one particular cell on that grid, and that cell would tell you what its arm's length return on sales should be under this simplified and streamlined approach. And so you have each cell giving you a return on sales output. There's a plus minus 50 basis points band, and the range across that entire matrix goes from 1.5% to 5.5% in terms of the ROS results. So far, so good. But this is not the end of the story. So the starting point is that there's this global matrix using global data and the underlying econometric analysis that has been undertaken to construct this basic framework. But this global matrix and the results, the 1.5 to 5.5 that I just mentioned, can in fact be superseded by a modified matrix. And that modified matrix is going to have the same construct, the 5x3 construct using the factor intensity and the industry groupings, but it's based on data for a subset of jurisdictions, so-called qualifying jurisdictions, where supposedly the thinking is that geographic differences are important such that for those subset of jurisdictions, the results, the arm's length results are different. And therefore, if you are looking at a tested party distributor in those jurisdictions, you would look to this modified matrix. And exactly as Georgia alluded to earlier, it is very likely that these results would be higher than what you start with under the global matrix. So now you have this added layer of complexity. And this is not the end of the story either. You can actually have the possibility, a country can actually create a country-level matrix following the same construct, the same 5x3 construct, using a local data set. And there are some safeguards that, you know, it has to, you know, follow the same methodology, and the data has to meet some reliability requirements that the inclusive framework will oversee. But you can see how this introduces a lot of instability and a very distorted set of incentives that, where possible, tax administrations would like to create that country-level matrix that would then apply and supersede both those other matrices that I just described. And the taxpayer would now look to that particular matrix based on country-level data that would apply for that country. And this is not the end of the story either. You could be in another set of jurisdictions where there isn't country-level data, so you're not in any of those qualifying jurisdictions, but you are considered a so-called high-risk jurisdiction based on your sovereign credit rating. And in that case, you would start with the results of the global matrix, but you would then calculate this an upward adjustment to those results, so-called risk adjustment, based on the sovereign credit rating and the interest rate spread associated with that, and apply that to your operating assets in those in that particular jurisdiction when those operating assets are expressed as a percentage of revenue. So again, I've oversimplified certain things, but there is this additional adjustment that you may need to think of. So a lot of complexity and a lot of uncertainty from the perspective of taxpayers as to what the outcome could be when they apply the so-called simplified and streamlined approach. And there is significant concern among taxpayers that, you know, the final outcome when you layer on these potential overrides and a potential adjustment, or a potential adjustment under the risk adjustment, you may actually end up with a result that doesn't look like an arm's length result based on, you know, all the benchmarks and stuff and the benchmarking analysis that taxpayers have seen over the years.
Thank you. What questions have you been getting from taxpayers since the release of the July consultation document? What is concerning them the most? And I'll start with you, Georgia.
So, Christina, as always, you can imagine that we are seeing a wide range of questions. And probably at one extreme, we have some clients that are simply seeking to understand what Amount B really is all about, and also really its likelihood of being implemented in the end. And this is in the context of the recent flood of documents published by the OECD and some countries, especially in the context of Pillar 2. And maybe it's useful to remember that for many of our clients, the priority at the moment is Pillar 2. So Amount B was a bit off the radar. On the other extreme, we have clients who know very well what Amount B is, and they are reflecting, for example, on the compliance challenges that Amount B could raise. For example, some clients have asked us whether they should opt to use local GAAP for Amount B, which is generally what they do for transfer pricing purposes, or whether they should instead rely on the consolidation pack, for example. And that raises questions on, you know, who should do what within the group. Or we have other clients that have distributors that perform different functions. So in this case, to go back to what Kartikeya was saying, the question is, should we section off the profit and loss account and the balance sheet? And if so, how should we do that? So a wide range of questions, Christina, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, to that, I would add one very common reaction that I've heard is the lack of transparency, which I'd alluded to earlier. There is, you know, in terms of the underlying data, the econometric methods, the makeup of the final set of benchmark companies, and also things like, you know, how different thresholds have been set and so on and so forth. So, you know, that's been one common sentiment that's been expressed, because, you know, if they had additional transparency, I think taxpayers would have felt that they could, you know, they could comment a little more comprehensively and more productively. So that's one comment. Then the other things that I'd mentioned around scope, the complexity that comes with scope, And just the overall complexity, this also this question around why services have been excluded, why digital has not been explicitly covered, why that's still an open question. And then the other feedback or reaction has been one that sort of expresses a lack of confidence in the pricing framework and the set of incentives that it creates for tax administrations as to, you know, you start with this global pricing matrix, but then you have so many different potential adjustments. How is that going to lead to a stable outcome? That's another common reaction that I've experienced from taxpayers.
Thank you both for that. And one last question for both of you. What are some takeaways that you can offer our listeners?
If I can start, Christina, with this question, probably I think that it's crucial, as we always say, it's crucial for clients to stay abreast of the progress under Amount B. And the main reason is that Amount B could really trigger changes or tweaks in existing transfer pricing policies. So very important to monitor the development around Amount B, even if we are aware that there might still be a long road ahead to reach consensus on several key issues, as we have said, for example, on whether the approach is a safe harbor or if instead it's a compulsory approach, or if certain countries, as Kartikeya said, will have the permission to use their own table of fixed returns. And this could really change the outcome of Amount B.
Yeah, and I have, you know, I have some reactions and observations that have, I think, some important implications. And I go back to the objectives that were set forth for Amount B. And I think inherently that meant that the design of Amount B had to manage a distinct set of trade-offs, one between simplicity and I'll call it precision, precision being, you know, strict adherence to the arm's length principle based on, you know, a full scope facts and circumstances based analysis. And I think there, based on what's there in the consultation document today, it seems that simplicity has been under prioritized. The other trade-off is one between taxpayers and tax administrations, and another one between tax administrations in market jurisdictions and tax administrations in other source jurisdictions where you have, you know, IP rights and so on and so forth. And I think in those trade-offs, it seems that the interests of market jurisdiction tax administrations has received more priority. And as a result, we go back to the question, you know, when you said earlier, what kind of reaction are we seeing among taxpayers? They are very, you know, understandably asking that, look, this was supposed to be all about streamlining, simplifying the application of the arm's length principle. And yet what we are seeing as of now is not a simplification, it's not a streamlining, and it may not even lead to an outcome that's in fact consistent with the arm's length principle as we understand it. It kind of, you know, when you put it that way, it reminds me of what Voltaire said about the Holy Roman Empire, that it surely wasn't holy, nor was it Roman, and actually it wasn't even an empire. So, you know, none of those three conditions are met, and that's the kind of reaction that you're seeing from taxpayers. What this means is that the comments that are being prepared are going to be extremely, extremely important. And how the OECD and the inclusive framework reflect on those comments and incorporate those in the next output and the final output, I think is going to make a big difference and is going to be fundamental to how this is received among all stakeholders and whether the objectives are going to be met that were laid out right at the outset.
Thank you both for that. It sounds like there's still quite a bit of complexity and uncertainty around Amount B, particularly for something that was meant to be this simplified approach. And also in some cases, you might even be ending up with a result that doesn't look like an arm's length result, despite, of course, that also being one of the goals of this guidance. But we'll want to stay tuned on how all of this unfolds.
Before I sign off, I want to thank Georgia and Kartike for joining me today to discuss the latest developments regarding the progress on Amount B, and thank you for sharing your thoughts. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We'll be back next month with our next episode of TP Talks. Until then, have a great day.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.